Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Man of Steel podcast. I'm Michael Steele. So glad you can hang out with the Man of Steel today. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, I've got a special one today, folks. I've been looking forward to this conversation. He's a good brother, as we like to say, from back in the hood. He's a guy who's been around the block a few times and knows the ins and outs of both politics and business, the one and only Anthony Scaramucci, founder of Skybridge Capital and former White House communications director. You can follow Anthony on Twitter at Scaramucci. Anthony, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast, bro.
Michael, it's a huge honor to be here, and I love the introduction. You forgot that I was trampled by the Washington media industrial complex and rolled in broken glass. You left that out of my introduction.
Yeah, well,
so I'm very, very happy about that. Thank you.
I think we've both kind of been in that space before. That's how that works. We both have had a few shards in our asses.
It's a rite of passage if you're going to work in the swamp. So say
of it. It is.
Know?
Well, there's a lot to get into. As folks know, when you come on this podcast, we're not about the heavy interview and the heavy questions. It's just a conversation. And just starting off, I've been looking around and just kind of taking stock of where we are. We're about 90 some days out from a big midterm election. The president is a year and a half into his thing. The public is looking around and seeing an economy that is strong, things moving in a direction that arguably they wanted because they voted for it in 2016. And yet and still there seems to be this unease. Do you have that sense that there's this unease out there in the country about a lot of the stuff that we see that's external and extraneous to policy and regulation, but it tends to be more personal and somehow makes you feel ooh, I don't know if I like that.
Well, I would say that on content and policy, I think the president and his team, frankly, has done a very good job, and you can see that on the economic dashboard of the economy. If you just look at all the vital signs for the economy, you can say, okay, they've done a very, very good job 18 months into the administration. But the problem is that the job requires a combination of content and style, and with style there comes delivery. And so what's happening here is that the president's disconnecting, unfortunately, on the style side from what his people really want. And I think the placating to the base or speaking his mind, all of these things that he attributes to the success of his election, mm-hmm. His electoral success, he would attribute to things like Twitter, smash mouth talking, shock jock politics, the Howard Stern of politicians. All of those things, he would say, enabled him to push through the 17 or 18 potential candidates on the Republican side, Secretary Clinton, in November of 2016. But now that he's president, some of those things, some of those attributes, some of those stylistic side effects, if you will, I think are hurting him. I think it's holding a ceiling on his public support. If you looked at the dashboard, Michael, and you said, okay, this was a different personality at the helm, I think the approval rating would be north of 50%. But it's stylistically, he's wounding himself with some of the things that he's doing. And it's not just the child separation policy. It could be the relationship with the press and declaring war on them. It could be, someone doesn't say something that he likes. He goes off on a tangent on Twitter with an ad hominem invective, none of which are necessary, none of which are going to get him to where I believe he would like to get, which is electoral success in the midterms and obviously a resounding reelection.
Right. So yeah.
It's a great irony here. He's got great content, but he's got a mismatch of the content with the style, and it's hurting him.
Well, you kind of raised some interesting points in it, and I want to touch on both of them. One has to do with the media and how that plays itself out, and in his recent and continuing declaration of war with the media. But before we get to that, I want to start with you talked about the personal invective. It was interesting, and maybe you can share some insights on this because I'm a student of politics. I've been watching this game for a long time, been in it a long time, and communication is a very big part of it. And I go back to the campaign and something you said during the campaign about Trump then, which I found to be interesting in terms of how it played out for you later on. At that time, you were on Fox Business Network, and you referred to the president as, quote, another hack politician. He's a hack politician. He's probably going to make Elizabeth Warren his vice presidential nominee, which, with comments like that. Of course, he said something inflammatory. But then you went on and you said, you can tell Donald Trump this. The only thing he's going to be president of is the Queen County's Bullies Association, right? And so that's pretty personal stuff. But
I think it was a pretty good burn, actually.
I appreciated it at the time. I thought it was pretty good. But what I found was interesting was, okay, when you became communications director, the fact that you became communications director after that, you noted at the time you did an interview, you said, you know, the president brings that comment up every 15 seconds, but claimed it hasn't changed your relationship with him. So here's the question, I guess, that roils around in my head in the face of recent events. How does that work with Trump? How are you able to say what you just said, among other things that you said, which arguably in politics is a very personal thing to say, and yet LeBron James, who never said such things, basically, all he said in the Don Lemon interview was, "Nah, I don't want to be in the room with him. I'd rather not sit down with him." And the president has gone after him, has gone after these other athletes in a way that is fascinating. You know, uninvited an entire football team to come to the White House. So what is it about that relationship with Trump? How does he define that relationship in a way that you get to say that and get to become communications director, and LeBron James, who said nothing nowhere near that, is played out in the public as being stupid and so forth?
So you have to remember, I want to take you back to the specific event. And so what was happening on that day, and that 3.5 minutes for me is going to live forever. It's like a permanent tattoo on YouTube. But what was happening on that day, he was live on Fox and Friends on the first floor of the Fox News studio. I was on the third floor at the Fox Business Network on Maria Bartiromo's show, and he was lighting up the hedge fund community, and he was casting aspersions at our entire industry,
right?
And
I remember
was
that.
Saying
right.
Some super mean and nasty things. Okay, so in the president's rules of combat, he was the one punching. Okay, I was the one counterpunching. And so when he hit as hard as he was hitting on the industry, I hit him back, which precipitated a phone call and precipitated a visit to his office that very day. And in his office, him and I had a, you know, clearing of the mind. One of his funny lines in his office that day, when I said, "You keep saying I've got a 15% tax bracket. By the way, I have a 53% tax bracket. I don't know what you're talking about." And then he said, "Well, I got to get you a new accountant," he said. I thought that was very funny. The point being is that in the president's mind, he started that fight.
Right.
And so in a weird way, he actually admired the fact that as a fellow New Yorker, I was able to get the gloves on and counterpunch back. And so I think that's why, in his mind, that situation canceled itself. I think in the LeBron James situation, knowing the president reasonably well, what happens to him, he's watching a show like that, and he's hearing that LeBron is saying that the president's dividing us through sports. And then I think the other blow that the president took, or the other punch he took in that conversation, was that he wouldn't sit down and meet with him, but he would have no problem sitting down and meeting with President Obama. And so those two things created a response. Obviously, he watches Don Lemon's show because, you know,
how
I just
know
that he does
right.
watch it. I've always,
right.
Yeah, of course. And I've always teased Don. I said that maybe he hate watches your show, but he does watch your show. And so I think knowing his combative personality, they're hitting him. He's taking that as a preemptive strike on him, and so he's counterpunching. And so I think that's where the difference lies with the president.
But Mucci,
it has to do with rules of engagement more than anything else.
Yeah, but they're his rules. It's his rules. It's not his rules.
No question.
It's his rules. Life isn't about your rules. Life is about all the rules. And so what I hear you saying is he's a man who delivers punches but doesn't know how to take one.
Differently. I'm saying that he delivers punches and he counterpunches super hard.
But he doesn't know how to take a punch.
And I think he would say to you,
I mean, you invite uninvited an entire sports team because what?
Mm-hmm.
The guy who's punching down, not punching up, but punching down, says, y'all bring your ass here anyway. Whoever wants to come. I'm going to show all you MFers up. That's what the guy who knows how to punch does.
So I like, you know, the reason why you and I get along is we both like calling balls and strikes. So let's call balls and strikes in the situation. Okay, I think what he did related to LeBron even prior to that tweet over the weekend, I thought was unnecessary, and I thought it was beneath him and beneath the presidency. He does not have to do that. And what he said about Don Lemon, he's more or less saying the exact opposite. Don is obviously one of the smartest guys on TV, not one of the dumbest. And so that sort of stuff I don't think is necessary. I think the First Lady believes that that's not necessary.
Right.
I believe it's not necessary. And here's the issue. If you're close to somebody, I think it's very important that you tell somebody the truth. I find these sycophants, and you know Washington is surrounded by sycophants, and yes, people, I find that they're incredibly disloyal. A disloyal person is someone that's going to sit in your office and tell you, yeah, that was a great tweet about LeBron and Don Lemon. You know, somebody that's loyal is going to tell you the truth. And I've run two reasonably successful companies, Michael.
Yep.
If one of my staff comes into my office and tells me I'm tall, and I'm right, now I know I got a problem.
Right, right.
But when they walk into my office and they say, hey, man, you're short and you're wrong, now I know I got a start of a relationship with somebody. See, and so what I don't get about what's going on here is that the people that are closest to him are willing to tell him the truth, and they're people that are actually related to him. You know, I'm not related to him, but I like him. And now people say, well, why the hell do you like him? Look at how he's handling himself. You shouldn't like him. Well, I got to be. I think he's well-intended, but I think what he's doing right now is very self-damaging. He's inflicting unnecessary damage on himself, the party, and other people in the periphery, and so he should really stop doing that. Now, he's got people on his staff. I don't know what they're saying to him. If they're encouraging him to do that, why don't you get out of the Washington shadows and all the lurking that goes on in Washington and just get in front of a camera and explain why you would encourage him to do something like that.
Then
if he's going to do it anyway, there's a whole other choice about, you know, what should happen.
Right.
But I think he's got to knock it off. I have said that.
No,
I don't
like the declaration on
the media.
You've been out there. I don't like the child separation
policy.
Right.
And I'm saying this because I want to support. I want to see him be successful. You know, you're a Republican. I'm a Republican. We're probably old-school Republicans.
Yep.
The president, let's call him a new-school Republican. Okay, he's on our team. I'd like to see him do better. So I don't see myself as being critical of him as much as I see myself being constructive.
Well,
you know,
I wrote an op-ed
a few weeks ago on the trade thing as an example.
Right.
And again, people say, oh, you're being critical of him. I'm not being critical of him. I'm being constructive.
I'm trying to offer
common sense in a situation that needs it.
But Anthony, that's where we've come to, though, and I think that has to do with how the president oftentimes frames these narratives as if it's an us versus them, or more appropriately, me versus everybody else. So this idea of, you know, constructive criticism, you know, I remember having several conversations with candidate Trump during the campaign. In which I tried to offer constructive criticism. Because, look, I get the whole outsider disruptive force. I've always been an advocate of that, particularly with institutions that get old and stale and rather moribund. I rammed my chairmanship as that and paid a price. You know, I pissed off a lot of people and who didn't like the direction I was trying to move the party and disrupting the, you know, the inner circles of cash and deals within the party. But I was willing to do that. But I also understood where the perimeters were, because I figured at some point I'm going to need some of these assholes to come with me to get some other bigger things done. And the president seems to lose sight of that last piece, that you're going to need some of these people out here who are trying to offer constructive criticism or who are trying to redirect you away from the very things you're just talking about. In a way that will lend to greater success, not the kind of morass we find ourselves in every day. I tell you, man, I hate going on television and just spending my time talking about the latest tweet of the president. I'd rather talk about substantive policy, you know, why Iran's economy is going to buckle under the direction the president has taken, why the tax cuts are going to benefit this group of people or that group of people. But that's not the conversation we're forced into.
So you and I are in violent agreement on everything that you just said. I just want to add two things that I think are important. He has spent 45, possibly 50 years of his life beating to his own drum, operating as a Lone Ranger without Tonto. And so his Lone Ranger strategy got him to the presidency. And so now that the deployment of that strategy, is it going to make for a successful presidency?
Yeah,
or
will
not?
It keep him there? Will that strategy keep him there?
Yeah, well, that's the point. And so now, what he would probably say if he was on your podcast is, yes, of course it's going to. Look at how great I'm doing. Look at the African American unemployment numbers, the Hispanic American unemployment numbers.
Okay, can I say something about that?
Look at how great I'm doing.
Yeah, but okay, throwing up a lower unemployment rate for African Americans does not a relationship with the African American community make. Having a preacher come in a sycophantic moment inside the Roosevelt Room of the White House and say one of the most asinine comments uttered,
about jungle media comment.
About the president, you know, that he's been the best president for black folks ever. It's just, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm kind of thinking like, you know, Reagan, Eisenhower, even Nixon, to a certain degree. So that does not a relationship make. And so when you're looking at these communities of interest out there, people who mm-hmm. vote, what is it about going forward? Do you think it's going to be a problem for the president? Look,
I think it's a problem. I think if you got Don Lemon on TV and he's calling you out and he's calling you a racist, and if you don't think he's a racist, Michael, and I don't think he's a racist, the behavioral pattern now is such where now the presumption is on him
to prove otherwise.
The president,
absolutely,
where he's got to prove otherwise because you know you can give him the benefit of the doubt only so much, and then when you see the pattern of behavior, you go, whoa, wait a second. If you may not be a racist, but boy, you are sending out signals, okay, that are not helpful to you in those communities. And the employment data and the wage data is not going to be enough for you. And my family yells at me, and I probably can't even believe I'm admitting this to you on this podcast, but my mom, you know, my sister will say, well, you're not calling enough. Well, you know, I may have helped you out financially in something, and they laugh at me and say, well, that's not enough. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, come on, that should be enough symbolically,
enough.
Right?
Right.
And I'm getting hit up from my mom and my sister, got to call me more. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so there's a message there, because it's about content and style.
Right.
And it's about behavior.
It's about something more.
And it's about a relationship. And here's the other thing it's about. We're human beings, and human beings want to be humanized. And so the bloodlust of politics has two-dimensionalized every one of us. You've been two-dimensionalized, Michael, through that process. So have I.
Yep.
So have other, you know, elected leaders. And I'm sure the president is feel that way. So why don't we break all of that down and add context and three dimensions and sit down, break bread, and have a human conversation. You know, I'd like to see the president on Don's show. You know, I'd like to see the president, rather than tweeting what he tweeted, and say, hey, LeBron, King James, I'm sorry you feel that way. You have an open invitation to the White House. If you change your mind, come in, let's sit down. Well, you know, when the president pardoned, you have to forgive me, I don't remember the woman's name, but when Kim Kardashian went to see the president and he pardoned the African-American woman, you have to forgive me, I can't remember her name, symbolically, that was like a pretty good message to the African-American community.
Right.
And so to me, again, not perfect, but I'm just saying, you know, there's things that you can do message-wise and things you can do symbolically that can really help. But money and economic data, just like in my own family, Michael, it's not enough.
It's not enough. And to that point, the shithole comment, the equivocation on David Duke, the certainly the Charlottesville moment, which I think was definitional. That was as definitional in terms of the black community for Donald Trump as Katrina was for George Bush. People recall George Bush was celebrating a 30% approval rating among African Americans prior to Katrina. It dropped to 3% after Katrina. Donald Trump, while not celebrating a great deal of support necessarily among African Americans, the trend lines were there because of other things that were going on. The combination of those events have weakened that. So to your point, and I think it's a right point. It's not enough just to do the external stuff. It's not enough to sort of meet a number. It is something more. It is about how personal you are willing to engage with the community in a substantive way. I can tell you straight up, Anthony, there are a phalanx of African-American Republicans who have been pushed to the sidelines, myself included, who tried to help the president during transition, who tried to help during the campaign, but were never really kind of brought into that circle to be, you know, administratively and otherwise helpful to the president. So it's as you look at the upcoming 90 days before the midterm elections, what do you think the president needs to do to convey to Americans more broadly, but the specific constituencies like African Americans and Hispanics, that they should trust his judgment and leadership, and the team of Republicans who are standing behind him and with him going into November?
Well, you know, everything you said, very well said. Again, I just want to add a few things.
Sure.
I would say that it's a tragedy that we're having this conversation.
I know. Trust me.
He has the skill set. He has the communication capability. And so there's a level of stubbornness and there's a level of counterpunching frustration that he is displaying on Twitter and elsewhere that's stopping him from creating, unfortunately, his own glass ceiling as it relates to approval. And he could be pushing through those boundaries into the mid-50s, and it could certainly help him and the Republican Party in the midterm. So there's a number of things he could do, and I'll give you the three most important ones in my mind. The first thing they should do is end the wartime declaration on the media. Stop using the word enemy.
Agreed.
When you say enemy, we're at war. If you want to say that we have an adversarial relationship, if you want to say, geez, I'm sorry, I disagree with you, if you want to say that we're competitive or we're ideologically different, I get all of that, but the wartime declaration is really working against him, Michael, because what's happening is the media is galvanizing. If you throw Caitlin Collins out of the Rose Garden, you've got Brett Baer on Fox News teaming up with CNN and denouncing the move to do that.
Right.
And so what ends up happening is you're getting a questionnaire, I think Haley, or forgive me if I didn't get her name right, I think it was Haley Jackson's asking Sarah a question.
Right.
Sarah's answering the question. She grows frustrated. She wants to flip it over to the Hill correspondent. He says, no, I'm good. I cede my time back to Haley.
Right.
See what's happening?
That was a good moment.
And so what they're doing is they're galvanizing against the administration because of this wartime declaration. Now, I get pushed back. Members of the administration say, well, you know, what about Candy Crowley and Governor Mitt Romney, 2012, second debate? where the governor was too polite to her.
Right.
And he got man or woman handled by her during the debate. And people said that he lost the momentum that he had in the first debate. Okay, I get the point that the media is 90% biased against the president, but there is a different tactic, a different strategy that could be deployed right here that might be working better for the president. Number two, he's got to do what Reagan did, and you were old enough to remember it, and so am I. When Reagan went into the South Bronx in the 1980 election, that summer, people said, well, what are you going up there for? That's a blue state. You're never going to win. He said, oh, no, you don't understand. When I'm president, I'm going to be president for everybody. And this is going to be one of my projects. I have to see if I can help create policies that will gentrify the Bronx and improve the living standards of all Americans. And so what that was is that was great symbolism, even though he wasn't necessarily going to win that county or win that state. And so the president needs to do more of that. And by the way, he was doing some of that during the election.
Yeah, he was.
He was going to the inner city of Cleveland. But the problem was,
I think the incoming started the incredulous responses to some of his statements and actions were beginning to take hold. And I saw the candidate retreat a little bit, then pivot and come back out swinging. Like going back to the first part of our conversation about how the president, will punch. And punch back a lot harder. But this leads to a very interesting question, I guess, because I've been thinking about this when I was sort of musing about, okay, I got Anthony Scaramucci. This guy knows business. He knows politics. How are those two worlds different and the same in trying to understand how Trump looks at his role now in politics coming out of business? Because a lot of us in politics have always believed, despite the famous, get a businessman to run the country. My view has always been, you really don't want to do that no more than you want to have, a 30-year elected official come in and run, Skybridge Capital. So, he may be able to help you with the regulations, the regulatory climate, but not much else. How do those two worlds under this president and you straddling both and he straddling both? What are the differences?
Yeah, and by the way, I failed in the political world because I missized the relationships there and I missized the cultural lingo in the political world. So, but again, I'm not trying to pick on people that are in politics, but it's a little bit more zero, in my experience at least, and I'm not saying it's generic or broad or definitive, but my experience is that there's a little bit of a zero-sum element to politics.
There is. That's not offensive at all. That's exactly right.
Okay, so people are vying for each other's power position. It's musical chairs.
Yep.
And if I'm perceived to having a little bit of an edge on you, no problem. Let me stab out your eyeball. Let me get three or four bad stories leaked about you, and let me see if I can dislodge you from your position. And so in the business world, it's way more collaborative, where
really?
it's a really?
Well, I saw Wall Street. Wait a minute.
Let me reframe it. So I'm saying it very precisely. It's way more collaborative inside of a company. It is kill outside the company,
but not
no
company
question.
To company, right.
I would say, and I can just speak about my firm, there are people in my firm, I run the firm, I'm the founder of the firm, they probably don't like my politics, and some of them probably don't like my personality, but they're like, okay, this guy's going to make me more money, 1 + 1, let's try to make it equal 3.
Right.
They'll tolerate me, they'll tolerate my personality if it means more bottom line dollars to them and their family. I don't think that's the case in politics.
No, I think people would agree
go
with
after
that.
Each other way harder.
And to your point, within the game of politics, and again, I can only speak from personal experience. When I was chairman of the Republican National Committee, I had to fight as much internally as I did externally. And ironically, my biggest fight was not with Democrats, not with Barack Obama and Chuck Schumer. Mm-hmm. It was with the party leadership on the Hill and certainly the political leadership around the country.
I got taken out by Republicans, Michael. I did not get taken out by Democrats. In fact, you know, the Schumer people couldn't even get to me. I was blown out of the system before they could
warm up the engines.
I got hit from inside the tent. It was a total inside job. That's fine. I'm a big boy about it. But you're asking me the difference, and I'm telling you why I think the president has to recalibrate a little bit, is that he's treating a lot of this stuff like business relationships. His negotiating style is combative, like in a real estate setting or real estate relationship. And he may be better served. The problem with all that is that because he's living in the largest aquarium in the world. I mean, the White House is literally a fishbowl that's being descended upon by thousands of media outlets. And so if he's ridiculing Chancellor Merkel, or he's taking a shot at Mitch McConnell, or he's ridiculing the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, it's national news. And where when you're in the private sector and you and I could have an aggressive rough and tumble negotiation,
right,
we can keep it under the wraps.
Right.
See what I mean?
Yep.
And so one of the big issues, one of the big differences now, he's dealing with people that are elected. They have their own constituencies. And if you're hitting them on trade, even if you're right, they're going to hit you back because they want to stay in the game and they don't want to be perceived to be weak to their fellow constituents or the people that are voting for them. And so where I really do believe he's a very adaptive person. I hope that he'll listen to somebody that he really trusts, where we'll sit down and say, okay, listen, game has changed. You are president of the United States. Put the phone down. Why don't you give yourself 2 or 3 weeks away from the phone?
Right.
Twitter will find you again.
Yes, it will. Starting, it ain't going anywhere.
After the midterm.
It's not going anywhere.
No problem. Put the phone down.
So talk about.
But I think he likes controlling the news cycle in the morning. He lights up the Twitter account at 6:30 a.m.
Right.
And everyone has to replay those tweets throughout the day. And he wants to control the news cycle. But I think there's stylistically a better way. I'll take you back to Mike Deaver and Ronald Reagan. There's a better way for him to control the news cycle where I think he could have more success and gain more popularity.
And he can do that by pronouncements of public policy, like you just
totally.
Like you noted before, showing up in communities that he's not expected to show up in, and mm-hmm. laying down relationships and tracks in a way that the narrative becomes more of, I didn't see that side of Donald Trump. I didn't know that side of Donald Trump. I used to tell people during the campaign, and you know this firsthand, Anthony, that the guy that I saw privately up in Trump Tower or standing in a corner talking was very different than the guy I saw standing in front of a microphone. And the guy that I thought should have been out there more was the guy who did certain things for his employees and people in the communities that now people don't think he has a relationship, black and Hispanic folks. So that I totally get that side of it. And I can see how the president kind of pulls, figures, well, I'm under attack, so I'm going to put the defensive armor on. I'm going to go out and I'm going to use the weapons that are at my greatest disposal, which is Twitter. But I want to go back to something you said, because I was struck when you were talking about the president being an adaptive person and the need for recalibration. So explain to me why he has not adapted to nor recalibrated himself when it comes to Russia's meddling in our elections. And the fact that you had last week 5 very senior members of his administration come out and declaratively state that the Russians were not only hacked the 2016 election to our country's national security detriment, but were in the throes of doing so leading up to this election. And the president comes out 24 hours later and goes, at his rally, saying, it's just all a hoax. Why can't he seem to recalibrate when it comes to Russia and be tuned in and dialed in to where everyone else in the country is on this?
Well, the short answer is personal stubbornness. And the longer answer is that it has to do with his pride, because he believes if he yields on the notion of Russians meddling in the election, it has some level of delegitimization. I'm going to be George W. Bush now and make up some words. And at some level of delegitimization of his electoral success. So in his mind, they're legitimizing his electoral success. And so
he knows how we elect the president, doesn't he? I mean,
yes, I understand.
It's an electoral college process, so there's no way that argument holds water, because it requires a level of engagement by the Russians that just is not provable at this point.
Right. Well, that's why I think he's conflating the two issues. You know, he's got in his mind the legitimacy of his election, the accusation of Russian collusion, which he believes that there was none, and the meddling. And so if you split the things and you look at them objectively, you have to look at and you have to take it at their word, our intelligence agencies who resoundingly kept us safe since 9/11, God bless them, but you have to take them at their word. And so you have to say there obviously was some level of Russian meddling, which is why he needed to walk back some of that conversation that he was having in public with President Putin in Helsinki. The other thing I would say, and again, these are just my opinions, and I don't mind sharing them, is that if you're under the gun and being accused of the collusion, drop it. Because if you're right on the facts, and I believe the president will be exonerated, mm-hmm. if you're right on the facts, the process, and maybe this is my naivete, Michael, and maybe this is the reason why I didn't last in Washington, but I still believe in the American legal standards and the American judicial system and American judicial process. And so, yes, were there people at the top, could Clapper or Brennan or somebody like Comey, have done some things that were politically contrived possibly and done some weaponization of those agencies? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not close enough to it. But by and large, the rank and file people that work in these agencies, that work in these departments are resounding patriots, men and women, and have done a great job. And so he should stand with them. Many of those people, frankly, have voted for him, mm-hmm. and many of those people supported him. So for me, you know, and again, no one's listening to me. Maybe there's your people and people listening to this podcast, thank you for listening. But if they were listening to me, I would be telling them, look, common sense dictates that you have to support your intelligence agencies. Common text if they stop talking about these investigations, let them run their course, because if the process is fair, and I believe that it is, and you've done absolutely nothing wrong, let it run the course, dial back the rhetoric, focus on policy, your approval ratings will go up.
So on that,
I really believe that. And so maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think it's going to take a little bit more at this point for the president to get above a 50% approval rating. And it's largely because mm-hmm. as stuff gets baked in with him, a lot of mm-hmm. stuff has gotten baked in with the American voters. And one of the things that I think it'll be interesting, and I know you got to get ready to run, and so we're going to get to this last question, and then we can get a beer and chill out the rest of the day.
But let me, if you don't mind, though, let me ask you a question.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Given what you know about the economy and given your political experience, and if you looked at the economic dashboard, the progress made in North Korea, uh-huh. some of the things that are obviously going on in Iran, and the opportunity here potentially to right-size the trade deals.
Right.
Had he been operating with a different style, do you think he'd have higher approval ratings?
Yes. Yes, he does. Now, he still may have some bumps will be on some fundamental stuff like, you know, protectionism versus free markets on the trade side. Okay. And that's
enough.
A legitimate policy discussion, but it's a policy discussion. I think, the sort of personalization of animosities between himself and Angela Merkel, for example, Theresa May, the sort of, you know, back and forth with our allies in NATO, where he stands on the stage with them and basically, you know, flips them the bird. And then he goes and he figuratively gives Putin a foot rub. Having changed all of that, I think the president would be in a stronger position, and the left would be losing their minds, not because of some crazy policy like locking children up in cages, because that wouldn't have occurred, but because they don't have any way to really get at him. Now, having said all that, Anthony, you know as well as I do that if a presidential election were held today, Donald Trump would win. And I dare say at this stage, given everything else that we know, and I know a lot of people hate to hear this, but hey, life's a bitch and you got to deal with it. If this were the presidential election in 2020, he will get reelected. And the real reason is you can't beat something with nothing. No matter how bad that something may be, it's still something for a significant number of Americans.
Well, the Democrats don't have a countervailing measure
at this point.
Totally agree. In a rising economy, going back to 1880, it's very hard to dislodge a sitting president. There's 140 years of history that suggests otherwise. You know, I mean, these guys get knocked out of office when the economy is in decline. So I agree with everything you said, but look, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I do think, though, he's getting to the end of the rope of tolerance from his friends, meaning...
I agree. I think that's right.
It's one thing to be a Trump interpreter and a Trump whisperer and to explain this and explain that and explain this and explain that, but now you're in territory of the unexplainable, and so you got to start walking it back and you got to start adapting yourself to the environment that you're in, because if you don't, you're going to put a hurt on your friends, people that want to see you do well. And I don't think that's something that he should be doing, frankly. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see how that unfolds as well. You
know? One last thought prediction. This November, 90 days from now, voters vote. What's the president's state of mind on Wednesday morning when he wakes up and Nancy Pelosi or some other Democrat is the incoming Speaker of the House?
So this is a little bit of a contrarian thought. And so first question is, are they going to win or not? I think that the likelihood is in the Democrats' favor, despite the fact that one of the best things the Republicans have going for them are the Democrats. So,
right.
But I do think that they'll have more turnout.
Right.
Okay. And I think, you know, I'm up here talking to you from Michigan and from Ohio, and the election turnouts up here are going to be measured related to, you know, referendums on the president.
Correct.
So if these break against the president, that'll bode very, very poorly. They're like canaries in the coal mine for the Republicans going into November. And so, but let's say that he loses, I'll say something very contrarian, that he may be able to use that to his advantage in the sense that he now has an adversary in Washington that he can go after, similar to what Clinton and Gingrich did in 1994 into the 96 election.
I could not agree with you more on that, and I'll tell you why, because I've always believed, again, you've known the president, know him a lot better than I do, but in the time I've known him since our relationship started in 2014 or so, he's agnostic about these things. He will work with whomever's sitting across the table from him. And I try to tell Republicans that so many times, you think that he's beholden to you because you're Republican. He could give a rat's ass about your label. He wants to know what kind of deal are you bringing to the table. You saw that when he met with Nancy and Chuck. And favored their approach over his own leadership. And that's because, in his view, it was a better deal.
Yeah, and so I agree with that. So in some ways, her rise or her reemergence could help him in a weird way. If they go full-blown at him and move for impeachment, and he handles that well, communications-wise, he could have happened to him what happened to President Clinton, which is a rise in the polls.
Right.
And some kind of voter sympathy where voters really want them to knock it off in Washington and just work and serve the American people, work on good policy rather than filleting each other with a steak knife. So we'll have to see. But listen, you know, I started out with Walker. I moved over to Bush. I've made a commitment that I would be with the Republican nominee when it was Donald J. Trump. I had known him a long time, had no problem supporting him. And I got kicked out of the White House after 11 days. And it is 11. I can prove it to all of your podcast listeners. It wasn't 10. And
it was actually 11.
I can tell you right now, I stayed loyal to him.
Yeah.
Okay. And so me offering constructive advice is a sign of that loyalty. And if it's taken otherwise, then that, you know, that's a real shame, because then who are you really going to listen to? If the people that really care about you and really want you to see you do well, when Ivanka is saying that the press is not the enemy of the people, that she shares her last name, and Melania is saying she'd like to visit LeBron James's school, wake up.
Yeah.
Wake up. You know, people are trying to message to you in a way, the people that really care about you, what the truth is,
yep.
You know. So I hope that comes to pass. I hope good things come for the Republican Party, Michael, and for the president. But, you know, what I do know about this country, man, what a country we live in. It can survive anything. We'll get through whatever. it doesn't matter. Whatever we got ahead of us, we'll get through. We've gotten through worse. I think we've got a very bright future in this country. If you think about the economic innovation and you think about the opportunity that our nation's youth has to once again seize all the advantages of our ancestry. So I'm very optimistic about our future.
All right. Anthony Scaramucci, he's affectionately known to his friends as the Mooch, all-around good guy, founder of Skybridge Capital, former White House communications director for 11 days. And as we both noted at the beginning, we both have our share of glass in places that we'd rather not talk about. But it's all for a good cause. Anthony, thank you so much for being a part of the Man of Steel podcast.
It's honored to be on, Michael.
Such a treat, man. Such a treat. And maybe we'll follow up with you after the election and do some analysis.
Great.
About what happened.
Look forward to it.
You got it. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you like to do your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. That's it for now. Check us out next week with another moment, The Man of Steel.